Okay, now the people, you recall, demanded a king. Samuel was opposed to it, but instructed by God, he went to set up a king. And the first king was Saul, a young man of a well-liked and respected family. To start with, he had everything going for him. He was good-looking, popular, nice personality, seemed like he'd make a great success as a king. However, it turned out later he was no good at all. Saul was first privately anointed king in the name of the Lord by Samuel. Still later, they held a public meeting to choose a king. Now, you see, Saul knew because Samuel had told him how this was going to turn out, but they had a big public mass meeting, the purpose of which, as announced, was to choose a king. Not chosen by a ballot vote, but by a lottery. This is a lottery not to draft an army, but to draft a king. And the Bible doesn't tell exactly how it was done, but evidently it was something like this. So here are the 12 tribes of Israel. The king has to be from one of those. So they elect the names of those: Judah, Benjamin, Ephraim, Manasseh, and so forth, each on a chip of wood or a little stone. These will be put in a bag and shaken up until one of them flips out, or somebody will be blindfolded and will reach in and take one. See which tribe it has written on it. So they do this, and it turns out to be Benjamin. They repeat the process with the major subdivisions of this tribe, and one of those is taken out. Then it is done another time with the families in that subdivision, and this time it turns out the family of a man named Kish, of the tribe of Benjamin. One more time for the individual men in that family, and this time it is Saul. So Saul has been chosen. Now, you should realize, of course, that from the human standpoint, lottery is pure chance. But with God, there is no chance. What is humanly uncontrollable and incalculable is not beyond the providential foreknowledge and control of God. There's a verse in the book of Proverbs, chapter 16, verse 33, says, "The lot is cast into the lap, but the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord." All right, God has made the choice. It is done in a way that man could not influence it, you see. Now they go to proclaim Saul king. His name's come out there in this lottery. And they can't find him. Poor Saul, he is so modest and so bashful and so retiring, he simply can't stand all this publicity, and they can't find him. This was held in a great big open field, and way off at the edge there's a half circle maybe of wagons and mules and donkeys and piles of straw and other gear that these people have brought when they came to this meeting, parked there off on the edge. And some men go in search, and here they find Saul hiding among all that gear. So they put him up on their shoulders and bring him back and acclaim him king. Hurrah! God save the king. So Saul is king. And they spread out a blanket or a sheet of cloth, and everybody comes past and congratulates Saul on being chosen king, and everybody throws in a little gift of money. Now it might be only 25 or 30 cents, but the aggregate would be a very nice haul. If everybody in the Geneva student body would give you 50 cents, I think you'd be sitting pretty financially after collecting this. So this is a little tip or gift to go with congratulations to Saul. However, there was one small faction there that didn't like Saul. For whatever reason, I don't know. Maybe they were jealous. The sons of Belial. This is a Hebrew word which means nothingness. The sons of nothingness. So if you want to call them something in real down-to-earth Beaver Valley language, sons of the devil. Or insignificant human trash whose opinions aren't important. How's that guy going to save us? He isn't any better than the rest of us. Give him money and congratulate him? I should say not. Nothing doing. So they scorn Saul and refuse to congratulate him or to contribute to this fund to give him a gift. And somebody comes and tells Saul, there's a bunch of people off here at one side, the sons of Belial, that's what they are, but they refuse to congratulate you or give you a gift. Now, what are you going to do about that? And Saul said, well, nothing. He's not going to do anything about it. He's not going to make an issue of this. It isn't worth it. This pleased the people that he did not make a personal insult like this, a matter of public action as king. He just let it go. And let me say, you're wise in life if you just let some things go. You can't make an issue out of everything that happens. And everybody that sticks their tongue out at you, you don't have to fight them for it. So he let it go. Now, everything we know about Saul up to now is still favorable to him. He went right back to his father's farm and went on farming and did no reigning as king. Saul understands perfectly well, although chosen to be king by really an act of God, he has not yet passed his senior comprehensive. To really be king, he has to lead his men to victory in battle and prove himself. And if he can't do that, well, he isn't going to be king, that's all. So he goes back to the farm. He understands the ideology of this perfectly well. Now, the next thing, a new character appears on the scene. Here is Rabbath-Ammon. That is today Amman, the capital of Jordan. A city of 200,000 with buses and air-conditioned hotels and everything. And the time we're dealing with, it was a small town with a wall around it. The capital of the Ammonites. These people are descendants of Lot, Abraham's nephew, and therefore distant kin of Israel, but at this time they are hostile, and their religion is entirely different, the Ammonites. And their king is a man named Nahash the Ammonite, a stinker of the first order. Nahash is a schoolyard bully on the map of ancient Palestine. Now, a schoolyard bully never picks on anybody his own size. He picks on and torments little boys smaller than himself. A cowardly kind of a business. And Nahash is like this. He won't fight any city or country that's a match for him. He picks out the little ones and the weak ones that can't fight him back and victimizes them in a very cowardly and mean way. All right, there's another. That's Rabbath-Ammon. There it is for today, Ammon. And up here is Jabesh-Gilead. Now, that's not the same as Ramoth-Gilead. This area is Gilead, and Jabesh-Gilead means Jabesh in Gilead, and this means Ramoth in Gilead, like we'd say Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Jabesh-Gilead, a small Israelite city. Not large, not powerful. And Nahash sends up a challenge to them. Men of Jabesh-Gilead, you surrender to me or else. If you don't, I'm going to come and fight you. The men of Jabesh-Gilead are up against it. They cannot fight him, and they know it. Other people have tried it and couldn't, and they can't. So what to do? They send back word, Nahash, you win, we surrender, we can't fight you. Tell us what the terms are. So Nahash sends a second message and says, all right, feel that way about it. These are the terms. I'll be up next week, and we'll line up all the men and boys of Jabesh-Gilead and put the right eyes out. And after I've done it, I'm going to brag on it through the land of Israel, north, south, east, and west. Nahash is the mighty warrior that put out the right eyes of the men and boys of Jabesh-Gilead. How do you like that now? That's Nahash for you. Now, the poor people of Jabesh-Gilead realize, of course, he'll really do it. He isn't just talking big words. So they got a terrible threat that hangs over them. What's going to do about this? They send word to Nahash and try to stall for time. Give us a few days' time, see if we can find anybody to help us. Nahash figured, well, I'm sitting pretty. Nobody's going to help you. I'm sure, take your time. Take me a few days to get there anyhow. And somebody at Jabesh-Gilead remembers that just recently Saul had been chosen king away over on the other side of the Jordan River. So they send messengers to Saul by the swiftest possible pony express to tell him of the threat that is hanging over the city of Jabesh-Gilead. Saul has not done any reigning as king. He's back on the farm, and when the messengers arrive, he's coming in from the field late afternoon with a team of oxen that he's been doing farm work with. And they tell this story about Nahash, and immediately the Spirit of God comes on Saul and energizes him. Now, this isn't the same thing as the Holy Spirit sanctifying you to make you a holier or a more godlike person. It energizes him with anger against evil and for action. The Spirit of God goes through Saul like an electric shock, and the adrenaline starts to pump through his veins and his bloodstream. Did somebody say a thing like that? We gotta fix that guy. And he's angry with righteous indignation. Let me add, it isn't always wrong to be angry. It depends on what you're mad about. If you can see somebody brutally misusing and abusing a helpless small child, and it doesn't make you angry, where is your red blood? Saul is energized with anger, and he takes and butchers those oxen right then and there and holds up a great big chunk of dripping, bloody, raw beef and says to one of the men, "Here, you take this to the tribe of Zebulun and tell them what Nahash said, and Saul is raising an army to fight that stinker Nahash, and anybody that is able to walk around that doesn't come and join the army, this is what is going to be done to his oxen." Didn't say to him. To his oxen. Here, this one goes to the tribe of Dan, this goes to the tribe of Manasseh, and so on, middle and northern tribes. So Saul is raising an army to fight Nahash. They are equipped with miscellaneous weapons, not the latest and best, but they got one thing that counts in war. They believe in their cause. He sends word to Jabesh Gilead, "Hold everything. Help is on the way." At this point, the citizens of Jabesh Gilead feel a little better, you know. The Marines are coming. And they decide to play a cat and mouse game with Nahash. So they send word to Nahash and say, "Nahash, we give up. It's no use. Come on, put our eyes out. Let's get it over with." And they get this timed as near as they can figure it so that the arrival of Nahash will coincide with the arrival of Saul, and they will meet and clash just a nice distance outside of the city of Jabesh Gilead. A very lovely arrangement, and it happens. Nahash is permanently liberated from this world. His forces are smashingly defeated. Jabesh Gilead is saved, and Saul is instantly the nation's hero. I'll add a postscript to this. Many years later, nearly 40 years later, when Saul had disgraced himself and dishonored the name of God and died of suicide, the Philistines put his body and those of his sons, strung them up on a city wall for an exhibit. And the men of Jabesh Gilead never forgot what Saul had done for them. And they marched through the night at the risk of their own lives and took down the bodies of Saul and his sons and buried them in graves. All right, now another big mass meeting is held. Saul is the nation's hero, and this time he's going to be king and no nonsense about it. He has passed his senior comp here with the rating of superior. And at this point, somebody comes and says, "Saul, this is the psychological moment. Those sons of Belial that didn't congratulate you or give you a gift, let's bring them in here and get them here where we are and chop off their heads." I wonder, that'd be a good idea? Well, some people might think it would. Saul said, "Absolutely not. This is a day of rejoicing. God has given us victory. We are not going to sadden this day or darken it by putting anybody to death." And this again pleased the people. Saul took this kind of an attitude, putting the national interest, you see, far above his personal affairs. Now, the next thing, they got in a scrap with the Philistines again. And here, of course, when fighting was done with the bows and arrows, the armies got much closer together than they could possibly get today. So here's a valley and a sloping hillside on each side. The Philistines are over there. Saul and his forces over here. And they haven't done any fighting. They're just waiting. And Samuel the prophet has told Saul that he would come within 7 days' time to conduct religious devotions and invoke the blessing of God on this battle. Meanwhile, Saul is getting increasingly jittery. The 7 days are passing. It isn't quite clear whether they really passed completely and Samuel was really late for his appointment or whether they had almost completely passed. Anyhow, it looks like the Philistines might attack just about any minute. And some of Saul's soldiers are going AWOL. And every day there's a greater number after looking the Philistines over, decide they like it a good bit better back on the farm. And so his army is beginning to desert, and he gets panicky, and Samuel hasn't come. So finally Saul says, all right, men, there's nothing for it. I'm not going to fight without religious devotions first. Bring some stones here and fix up an altar and bring the proper equipment and so forth, and I will conduct the sacrifice. Now, he could have prayed to God, but to offer sacrifice he was not permitted to do. This was reserved in the law of God to the priests, and he had no right to do it. They did not have the separation of church and state as clearly defined as we have it, but the functions of the political officers like the king and the religious officers like the priests were very distinct, and every time in the Old Testament when a king interfered with the functions of the priesthood, God did something to him about it. The priests are the conscience of a nation and must not be tampered with in any way by the political government. All right. He offered the sacrifice contrary to the law of God. And he just got through with the last amen. And here comes Samuel. What are you doing, Saul? Well, prophet, you didn't come when you said you would. And the Philistines are getting ready to attack. And my men are going AWOL. More of them every day. And it's getting pretty critical here. And finally he said, I forced myself and offered the sacrifice. Saul, you did a fool thing. You think you're going to get the blessing of God by violating the law of God? You did a fool thing. Now, Samuel told him off like it really was. They did win some victories over the Philistines. And then later on, God commissioned Saul to... This was the first step, really, in Saul's deterioration. He went to pieces physically, mentally, and spiritually. You see from here on out the falling apart of a personality, disintegration of a personality. And that was the first step in it, this offering the sacrifice when he had no right to do it. Now, the next thing, there was a bandit people called the Amalekites. Across the Jordan, in the edge of the desert, they were nomads, a roving, gypsy-type tribe of people, with a record of hundreds of years of unprovoked hostility to Israel. Way back in Moses' day, when Israel was coming across the Sinai, these Amalekites would attack them in the rear. And any sick folks or old people that couldn't keep up very well, they would pounce on them and kill them. And they'd been doing that kind of thing ever since. And finally, God decided they'd done it long enough and ordered Saul to exterminate them. Now, this bothers us a little. In order to exterminate the entire people, didn't bother Saul one bit. He went about to do it. This is the judgment of God. God could have done it by a tidal wave or an epidemic or a hurricane or most anything, but he ordered Saul to do it. And the animals were to be destroyed too. Now, you might say, what have those poor camels and sheep and oxen and cattle done to be killed? The answer to this is, this had to be done in order that nobody would ever be able to say that this was a raid for booty. Now, it was a favorite method of balancing the national budget in ancient times, to raid another country and take everything they had. If Governor Schaap needs more money to run Pennsylvania, you know I'm feeling it when I get my paycheck in that state income tax. If he needs more money, that's not the way to do it. Get the militia out and stage a raid on West Virginia or upstate New York and take everything. Take every piece of furniture out of every house, every dollar, every object, all the livestock, kill the people or take them prisoners, and strip the country like you'd pick the feathers off a dead chicken. This is terribly hard on the raidee, but it's perfectly amazing what it does for the raider. Of course, it isn't very ethical. But on the other hand, this is how some people used to do things. Now, the Israelites weren't supposed to do this, although maybe they did sometime. And if the animals were not destroyed, this would lead people in later times to say this was a raid for booty. They did it to get something. And it is not. It is the execution of the judgment of God, and all they're to get is some blisters on their feet. Well, Saul goes to do it. He kills the Amalekites pretty well. He saves their king alive, contrary to the command of God, and Samuel later killed him, killed the king of the Amalekites. But they saved a lot of the animals alive, cattle and sheep especially. Just at this point, Samuel appears, the old wet blanket, you know, always spoiling what Saul's doing. And Saul puts on his oiliest, pious front. A person can do this with a little practice. They can look religious. And they put on an oily-looking, pious front to meet Samuel. Blessed be thou of the Lord, I have carried out the commandment of the Lord. That's what Saul says. Yeah, I have you. What's that noise I hear? Sounds to me like the mooing of cows and the bleating of sheep. Oh, Samuel, hold everything. I'll explain everything. And Saul proceeds to give two excuses why these animals hadn't been killed. Now, what do you think? Is a poor excuse better than none? Huh? Student wants to change their Bible course, and the registrar requires a reason, so they write in just because. Saul has two excuses, and neither of them holds water when Samuel calls him on this. The first is, the people forced my hand. Now, what kind of a king is it that says, the people forced my hand? Remember, kings were supposed to be kings back in those times. They weren't a piece of bric-a-brac like today. Their word was had authority. And here Saul says, the people forced my hand. That's just another way of saying I'm not fit to be king. I better resign and let somebody else be king that can get his orders carried out. That's the first excuse. The second is, they did it with a religious motive to offer these animals as sacrifices to the Lord. Now, does that make it right? There was a woman in Western Pennsylvania about 6-7 years ago that worked in a savings and loan association, and she juggled the books and embezzled several $1,000s by juggled bookkeeping. She was indicted by a grand jury and convicted by a jury, and is now, I guess, cooling her heels as a guest of the state somewhere. But to several $1,000s, and she alleged in her defense that she had embezzled this money to give it to two poor families that needed it. And the judge said, that's too bad, but that doesn't justify embezzlement. A student in here yesterday said it did, that she had a right to do that for the benefit of the poor families. And I said, all right, what about the poor families that have put their life savings in that savings and loan? Said, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation will bail them out. Well, I'm afraid I take a dim view of embezzlement. I'll give you another illustration. There was a little church in northwestern China that had a hard time raising money to pay their pastor. Now, let me urge you, if you are thinking of going into the ministry as a way of getting rich quick, you have a lack of business sense. This little church had a hard time paying their pastor even a passable salary for his services. And then one of the members had the bright idea, let's set aside one field, 1 acre of ground, and call it God's Acre and plant it to opium poppies. And to sell the opium on the black markets and give the money to our pastor. Now, this was at that time an illegal traffic in that place and at that time. However, it was very profitable if you could get away with it. The fact that it was illegal greatly increased the price you could get for the opium, of course. And so you could really come into the money if you could do this and get away with it. So this was the proposal. We'll plant a field of opium poppies and support our pastor in the way that his efforts and talents really deserve. The motion was made and seconded, and to the credit of this little Chinese church, they voted it down. And their pastor went on living on beans. That's what they could do for him, same as before. Now, Samuel didn't take any of this off of Saul. The people forced my hand, and we did it to offer them to the Lord. Hath the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? To obey is better than sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of lambs. Rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. You have rejected the Lord, and he has rejected you from being king over Israel. Goodbye, Saul. And Samuel walked out on him and never spoke to him or had anything to do with him again. All right, Saul goes to pieces. The Spirit of the Lord departs from him. an evil spirit permitted by God enters into him.
The symptoms are the wildest kind of paranoia. Now, paranoia is the mental illness where you have the delusion that everybody's out to get you. If one of you would say, every member of the Geneva faculty is trying to flunk me out of college, you're paranoid. If it's only the Bible professor, you're not. But if every member of the faculty is trying to flunk you out, if somebody says, every family on the block is trying to shoot me, this is delusions of persecution. And it isn't necessarily caused by a demon or an evil spirit. It can be caused by drugs. It can be caused by brain damage and so forth. But a demon could cause it too. And the cause here is this evil spirit from the Lord, and the symptoms, you see, the external manifestation is this wild paranoia, or it's all his seizures. He keeps a javelin, a big round pole with a sharp-pointed spearhead on the end at his side, and when the seizures comes on him, he winds this around and hurls it, sticks in the wall, or preferably in a human target. Anybody will do as long as it's human. That's all. What do you do with a king that's like this? He has these spells and seizures, and he's really, really dangerous. Well, you know, no psychiatrists and no tranquilizers, and I'm not sure they could have cooked your soul anyhow, because the real cause of this was spiritual. But somebody heard that there was a kid that could play the harp, or the try music, David of Bethlehem. David is God's choice for the next king, but nobody's supposed to know about that yet. David, a lad, seven older brothers. How would you like to have seven older brothers tell you what to do? Or seven older sisters? Well, that's David. He had a nice personality in spite of it. Maybe because of it. I don't know. Anyhow, he can play the harp. And when Saul has one of these spells coming on him, they get David in. David goes in the room or tent where Saul is and starts to play no hard rock, but real tranquilizing music for easy listening. And this doesn't cure Saul, but after a while, his tortured nerves quiet down, and he heaves a sigh and leans over and falls asleep. This doesn't cure him, but it gets him past it for that time. So David is in and out of Saul's place there, you know, play the harp. Now, next thing, we'll take up the history of David and Goliath. This is chapter 17. Another war with the Philistines shapes up. David apparently had not been at Saul's place for some little time, back home on the farm. And there's a battle shaping up with the Philistines, and again, at fairly close range, and they're on one side of the valley, and Saul and his army on the other side. And the Philistines have a so-called champion named Goliath of Gath. All right, so Goliath of Gath is a great, big, boned, brawny bruiser with practically nothing in the upper story. The amount of brawn and bone and weight that Goliath has is amply compensated for by the extremely low IQ. He also has the genetic oddity of 6 fingers on each hand and 6 toes on each foot. And last period I said that was the Mendelian recessive, and at the end of the period a student promptly brought me a book on biology with a picture of a man like this and said it is a dominant and not a recessive. So I said, all right, then you just have to have one pair that has it together. Now that's Goliath. He is not a Philistine. He is apparently one of the straggling few left over of a prehistoric race, somewhat over the average human size, maybe a little like the Cro-Magnons of Europe. But anyway, he's on the Philistine side, and he blows hard for them. Every morning, Goliath comes out and faces across the valley there to the army of Israel and puts on a broadcast. I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man to fight with me. I'll fight him. If he kills me, okay, you win the war. If I kill him, we win the war. I defy the armies of Israel. Send me a man to fight with me. I'll fight him. And this is followed by a long string of Philistine swear words. Talk about atmospheric pollution. The air is blue for 20 minutes after Goliath gets through with the Philistine cuss words of all the names of the Philistine gods. And when he does this every morning. And when he puts this on, Saul's soldiers simply shake in their shoes. And Saul, he goes in his tent and pulls his tent flap shut.
While Goliath is out there broadcasting his morning commercial. Now, David has three older brothers in Saul's army. They're here at this battlefront. And his father sends him up there with some special food for them and a little gift for their captain, and they get news and come home again. And he arrives right while Goliath is putting on this broadcast. So David finds a sergeant or somebody and says, "Who is that guy anyhow?" "Oh, son, don't you know who that is? That's Goliath, the mighty Philistine champion. He does it every morning." "Well, why doesn't somebody go in there and tip off his head? Is he going to be allowed to blaspheme and curse the armies of the living God like that? Take off his head." "Listen, son, we're all scared of him. Well, suppose if somebody could kill him, what would the reward be?" "Oh, the reward, all right. The king announced it quite a while ago." "Well, what would it be?" "Well, the reward would be a double reward. Anybody can kill him. Part one, his family will be permanently tax-free in the land of Israel. And part two, he can marry the king's daughter and become the king's son-in-law. Now, knowing something about Saul's daughter, I suggest the first part of this reward was distinctly the better part. But anyhow, David said, "All right, I'll kill him. Take me to the king." So this sergeant takes David to Saul's tent. Saul opens the tent. "Well, here from Bethlehem says he'll kill Goliath for you." Saul didn't recognize him. Some critics of the Bible have wondered if David had played the harp at Saul's tent, I wouldn't recognize him. Answer, that may have been quite a while before. David may have grown up some since. Also, David was brought in when Saul had seizures, and very likely he couldn't remember anything that had happened during those seizures, so this is quite understandable. "Your son got to fight Goliath with me. You're just a teenager. And he's a mighty fighting man of years of experience. You can't fight him." "Listen, King, I was looking after my father's sheep on the hills back of Bethlehem, and there came a lion and took a lamb, and with my bare hands I saved the lamb and killed the lion. Another time I saved one from a bear. And God that saved me from the lion and the bear will save me from this Philistine." Now let me explain here. David was not making this story up, neither was he bragging. It was true. I recommend very strongly that you leave lions alone, but if you ever do have an interview with one, this is the technique. Remember that the lion had already clenched his jaw on the lamb, and he couldn't bite David without letting go of the lamb, and he wouldn't do that. You grab the lion by the back of the neck, the scruff of his neck, the skin on his neck with your left hand, and get an iron grip on that, and you grab his hair or his chin with the other hand, and get a grip on that, and you give a sudden jerk. This dislocates the lion's jaw. After this, he is not important anymore. Incidentally, it saves the lamb. So David had done this. The king said, "Well, son, I guess we'll have to let you try. We offered a reward. You put on this armor." So they dressed David up in a suit of bronze chain link armor that weighed about 85 pounds. And he walked back and forth in front of Saul's tent. "Not me. Too heavy. I'm not used to it. Take it off." So they take it off. And Saul says, "Well, I have to let you try. After all, we offered a reward." "Well, God bless you, son." So David starts out. Now Goliath sees him coming on the other side of the valley. "Whoops! They're sending a little boy to fight me. Must be they haven't got any men over there. Come on over here, little boy. I'm going to feed you to the birds for the breakfast. Goliath, you come to me armed with a sword and with a shield and with a spear, and I come to you armed with the name of the Lord God of Israel, whose armies you have defied. And listen, Goliath, I'm going to cut your head off. And all the world will know that the Lord does not save by conventional weapons." This made Goliath mad. He started running down the hill, and he started the Philistine square word. Whole string of it. Making the air blue again. And, you know, the Philistines could really cut. And David goes down the hill on the other side and picks up five little smooth pebbles out of the brook. Now, David had spent thousands of dollars watching his father's sheep, the most monotonous job on earth. No transistor radio or anything, you know. What do you do to pass the time? He had passed the time practicing shooting at a mark or target of some kind with a sling. Not a slingshot, but a sling, a few whirls. And he had done this so long that he had become a dead shot with a sling. Added to this, he's a healthy outdoor kid with fine muscle and perfect eyesight, you know, and the blessing of God is on him. Five little smooth stones. Only one of them ever got used. The other four were just prepared for emergency. Put them in his little shepherd's bag. And when Goliath puts on the spiel of cuss words, David puts one little stone in that sling and whirls it, and lets fly. Pink! It's Goliath in the forest. Not quite the velocity of a rifle bullet, but pretty nearly. Goliath topples over on the ground and has penetrated his skull, although he isn't dead. And he's just vibrating on the ground and shaking. And at this point, the Philistine soldiers over on their side turn white in the face and let out a gasp. And the Israelite men on their side are holding their breath. And David runs to where Goliath is lying on the ground. They all started coming and shaking. And David has no weapon but that sling. But Goliath has one, a great big sword in the sheath. So he pulls that out, grabs Goliath by the hair, and goes, whack, 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 and holds his head up like that. At this point, the Philistines turn and run. And Saul's soldiers, amazingly, suddenly get their courage back. And David says, come on, come on, come on, come on, chase them. So they chase them for miles. And win a great victory. The Philistines are out of business for quite a while. And when that day is over, the men gather in at the towns and cities, and the women in some places have made a sort of a song to welcome them, and we have a sample of it. I don't suppose it's the same in every town or place, but sample of the Bible. The refrain, the punchline is, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000. And Saul says, well, they give me credit for 10% of his victory and David gets credit for 90% of it. What more could he want but to be king instead of me? And from that point on, Saul could never look at David without them wanting to kill him. Now, for years, David had to dodge around in caves and wild places to keep out of reach of Saul. One point he said, I am hunted like a partridge on the mountain. Another time he said, there is just one step between me and death. David was strictly correct in his conduct towards Saul. He knew he was going to be king, but he would not do anything to get this for himself. And he's waiting for God's time, and he is not guilty of any improper conduct towards Saul, who, after all, was still a king. David gradually accumulated a private army, a Robin Hood style, of 400 men who were hopelessly in debt, the victims of times, the people cruelly treated by their masters and so forth. And these protect farmers against real bandits and get some handouts in return, but David does not allow any looting or stealing by his men. They're strictly under discipline and control and no choices for that kind. So these are men who have everything to gain by a change in the government, but they're waiting for God's time. Two or three times, David had a dandy opportunity to kill Saul. He came on Saul one time in the fields or woods. Saul was asleep, and a spear stuck into his side just to mark where the king was sleeping, and a jug of water. And Abner, Saul's armor bearer, who should have stayed awake to guard him while the king slept, down there snoring. And David's armor bearer said, David, this is God's opportunity to kill your enemy. John quick, for his